Hello, everyone. Not every time I get up to speak, but only when I come out to California, it seems. It's true. You know, I've been out here now. This is my fourth trip, and on three of those trips, and one to Ohio, I just wind up in the hospital. It was back in June. I came out for a tour that had been all set up for me. I didn't do anything except pick up the phone at home and say, okay, I'll do that, you know. And a whole tour from San Diego all the way up to, Langley, Canada, was set up over 6 weeks. And I began in San Diego at the Chula Vista Church, got up around 10 to 7, was setting up my computer and the pulpit, and had a heart attack. Yeah, okay. Wound up in the hospital that night. They put a stent in and was out on Sunday. Fortunately, they were able to go online and get some presentations that I had done at camp meetings that were recorded by audioverse.com, and they were able to watch that. But on Tuesday night that week, I felt well enough to go and have a Q&A for 2.5 hours. People said, Rick, you need to go back home and rest. You had a heart attack, you know. And I said, I'll have another heart attack if I go back home and rest, you know. The Lord established those meetings just like I believe he established this one right here. And it seems that every time I get up to speak on this subject, the Omega Rebellion, the book that I've written, we're at war. I can't explain it, you know. It's almost a little embarrassing to say, yeah, every time I get up to give a message, the devil attacks me, you know. I don't understand those things. I really don't. It's a fact. I don't know why. I know that God permits anything that happens to happen. You know, he's in control of everything in the universe, and I don't try to explain it. I'm just going to keep going, and I keep going only by invitation. I determined at the beginning, when this book finally came out, that I would go no place unless I was invited, because it was the only way that I could feel that God was in control. You know, there are places to give a message, especially a divisive message. You want to be doing it according to God's timing. And people say, well, that, just like I just said, that's a divisive message, and we don't want to hear that in the church. Well, that's not right, okay? The truth is always divisive. When Jesus spoke the truth, it caused division. And in our church today, we know that before Jesus comes back, what's going to happen? Is there going to be a, what do we call it? The shaking, right? Is that going to be divisive? Absolutely. The wheat and the tares in our church come up together, right? And thank God we don't have to decide who the tares are. The angels do that work, right? That's up to them. But it will happen. There will be a shaking. It's a fact, if we accept the spirit of prophecy, which I hope you all do, that the church will appear as if it's about to fall. And what does that mean? I mean, we know that near the end of time, when you can't buy and sell, we're not even going to be able to meet in a place like this, all right? Because you can't own anything. You can't even buy fuel for your car or food. This is what it will be like right before the end. So yeah, things are going to change, and to think that this is just a time of happiness and joy and celebration, no, it's not. It's a very solemn period that we're living in right now. Jesus is coming back, and a world needs to be warned that they need to prepare for his coming. It is the end of all things, and we are the generation that God has called to be alive at this time. Isn't that fantastic? And solemn and serious. All right, so it's not all good times. There are good times. There is a form of celebration. There is joy and peace in the heart. Even if you have to give your life, you can have joy and peace while you're giving it. Isn't that true? That's what Christianity is all about. It's having Jesus here that makes you rock solid. No matter what, you're willing to do whatever he calls you to. You know, I want to share a little bit. Lauren, where are you? Lauren was a member of my church back in Hilton Head, South Carolina. When I retired about, when did I retire? I don't know when I retired, a year and a half or so ago. And I didn't know whether to retire. Excuse me. I was offered a church again in the Carolina Conference. But it was her dad, her grandfather, that inspired the writing of the Omega Rebellion, believe it or not. He was my head elder. You may have heard of Ken Holland. He was the editor of The Signs before Marvin Moore. And he's written a number of books, and he's been in the publishing work most of his life, Ken and Maureen. And he, during that time that he was my head elder, I know that I'm to share a testimony of how I became a Christian. I will. Part of it, though, is I'm going to start at the end because it's important. And Ken was my head elder, and any time that I preached a sermon that involved spiritualism, or I even mentioned something about spiritualism or the supernatural or the occult, which Rosalie and I were involved. Rosalie, where are you? That's my wife back there, Rosalie. I'll talk about her a little bit more in a few minutes. But we spent about 5 years in the occult, the psychic phenomena, spiritualism with a spirit medium. We were disciples of a guru along with Santana, you know, the great rock and roll Santana. We were in the same group together back in New York of the highest disciples of Sri Chinmoy, who was the spiritual leader at the United Nations back in those days. He's also passed away. But Ken Holland, my head elder there for 10 years, whenever I preached a sermon involving anything having to do with that, on the way out of church, and I'd be there at the door shaking people's hands, and Ken would grab my hand and he'd lean over and he'd go, "Rick, you got to write a book about this." I mean, he must have said that 100 times to me. "Yeah, yeah, I know, you're right. And I'm just not a writer. My writer, I was a research chemist, and it's technical stuff, you know, and I'm just not a writer. I can write, you know, but not what you'd want to read." Luckily, I have a wife that took what I wrote and turned it around and made it interesting. But anyway, I think it's interesting anyway. I'm assuming it is. That's what people tell me. And so year after year went by, 10 years, matter of fact, and I just never got around to it. But I knew it was always there. I've got to write something about, you know, what I'm convicted of in my heart. Well, Ken passed away. 89, I guess he was 89. He just had his 89th birthday. And it was about a year later, and I'm in my office at church praying. And I'm just praying alone, you know, and all of a sudden, from nowhere, "Rick, you got to write a book about this," comes into my mind, you know. And I'm not going to say I heard a voice. I don't know what I heard, you know, but it was there, and I knew what God was telling me to do. He was telling me, "Rick, you got to write a book about this." So right then and there, I got out all my notes and books that were in my office, everything having to do with the subject at hand. Wasn't even sure exactly what direction I was going in. My desk was piled up with stuff, you know. Four people walk in the church. I hear them come in into the lobby, and I see some flashbulbs going off. And I reluctantly got up. I didn't want to get up. I finally got started doing what I had been waiting 10 years to do. Well, not waiting, but put off for 10 years. And I got out in the lobby, and there were two couples. And they said, "Oh, what a beautiful church. You know, do you mind if we roam around and take some pictures?" So I showed them around a little bit, and I said, "That'd be fine." I said, "Look, I'll be in the office. If you need anything, you come on in, see me." So about 10 minutes later, I look up, and one of the ladies of these two couples is leaning on the door jamb, looking at me. And I felt a little conspicuous because she probably thought I should be institutionalized. My desk was piled with this junk. And so she said, "What are you doing?" Just like that. And I said, "Well, actually, I'm beginning to study for a long overdue book." "Oh, what's it about?" And I had no idea that she would know anything about it. And I said, "Well, it's about the Alpha and the Omega." "Oh," she said, "we need a book about that." And she reaches her hand across and walks over and shakes my hand and says, "My name is so-and-so, and I'm the vice president of Pacific Press." "Oh, wonderful. Well, sit down," I said. And she sits down and spends the next 2 hours telling me everything I need to know, you know, to who to contact, how to write the book, just giving me advice because it was the first time I was writing a book. And then, lo and behold, she's great friends with the Hollands. This is the first time she ever set foot in our church, passing through from London to California, right? And she just happens to pick the Hilton Head Church the morning after me waiting 10 years to write this book, happens to be friends with, you know, knows the Hollands dearly, friends with Ken and Maureen. You know, I just knew God was telling me, you know, "Rick, yeah, I want you to write this book. Right, this is just evidence, edification. Keep going." And let me say this. At every advance move to get this book from my head into the hands of our people. How many of you have seen The Omega Rebellion, have read it? Yeah, okay, good. And you either love it or you hate me for writing it. That's what's happened, okay? I mean, this afternoon at Meadow Vista, I'll share some things. An email that I got yesterday from a professor that is so nasty, and he is so angry with me, of course, because he teaches the very thing that my book says is a satanic deception that has come into our church. Now, look, I'm either crazy and misled, misguided by Satan, or I'm being led by the Holy Spirit, and he is being misled by Satan, one or the other. Now, I have backed up everything in my book with the spirit of prophecy. All right? He does nothing but criticize and get angry at me. You know, when you're a lawyer and you go to law school, they tell you something. They teach you, if you have the truth, in the courtroom, you argue the truth because you've got the truth. But if you don't have the truth, destroy your opponent's reputation. Ridicule, criticize, destroy him. You know, that's exactly what's happening here. I see it. And that's okay. I have no reputation that I care about anyway. You know, I really don't. I'm serious. None of us do. Look what we're really like. If it wasn't for Jesus, what are we really like, folks? You know? So if you have to suffer ridicule or criticism for the truth's sake, let it be. Who cares? You know, don't let it get you down. All right? Because in the end, when you're standing in heaven, looking back at the life that you've led and the way God led you, you will agree with everything that Jesus did. Everything that God did, you know, will be okay with you. You'll say, "It's all right, Lord. It's all right." You know, no matter what happened to me, is it anywhere near what Jesus had to go through to save me? No. No. So if I get sick and I get attacked and I have to go through whatever I'm going through, okay. You know, it's not easy. I admit it. You know, we're human. But we have to cast our faith on Jesus and say, "Look, if we've got to suffer, no matter what it is that we suffer, it's for his sake, to share in the suffering that he went through in order to save us all. We're a family, all of us. We're going to be spending eternity together, all of us." What a thought. What a thought. No more tears, no more sickness, pain, crying. You know, we'll be living on the new earth forever and ever and ever. We'll go on special envoys with the Lord across the universe, sharing our testimonies. you know, whatever part we can remember, not the real nasty parts, but, you know, just talking about how God saved us. You know, it's just, it's a wonderful thought. So this book is about a deception that has been sweeping the Protestant world. It originates with the Jesuits. It does, all right? And when I say Jesuits, everybody associates that with the Roman Catholic Church. And just let me say this, that, hey, you know, there are many wonderful Roman Catholic Christians. Right? We're not talking about individual Christians who are living up to the light that they have, who love Jesus, the Jesus that they understand and know. All right? But we are talking about a system that was established to counter the Reformation. That's what the Jesuits were all about. They were put together to counter what Martin Luther was discovering. And the Jesuits were founded by Ignatius Loyola, who was a contemporary of Martin Luther. The two of them lived at the same time. The two of them were convicted of sin in their hearts. They needed salvation. Martin Luther went back to Scripture to find the answers to his guilty conscience. Ignatius Loyola didn't want to think about a guilty conscience. He couldn't deal with it. He said, I don't want to have any negative thoughts. I don't want to think about sin, shame, guilt. I don't want to have those thoughts. I want to have just good thoughts all the time. And I want to see God everywhere in everything. Well, you know, that's not the plan that God has for us. And if you insist on wanting things to be the way you want them to be rather than the way God wants them to be, Satan will be right there to give it to you if you insist on it. In other words, if you reject truth and say, I want things to be this way, and I don't care what the truth is, I want it to be this way because I want it to be this way, Satan will be there to supply your needs. And that's exactly what happened. Loyola wound up having a vision. And in 3 minutes, he said, he learned more than he learned his whole entire life. And he wrote those down. They're called the 13 Spiritual Exercises of Ignatius Loyola. And from those 13 spiritual exercises that were supernaturally given to him by Satan, was manufactured spiritual formation that's being taught in Protestant churches today, in Protestant schools and our schools. Okay. All right? Now, since my book came out, in our schools, because Elder Ted Wilson, our new conference president, also understands this, and happened to write an endorsement that covered half of the back of my book, that he had to withdraw on the day that it went to print because someone came in his office and said, you can't do this. You can't endorse a book until it goes through the BRI if you're the president of the General Conference. So he had to take that endorsement off the back of the book. But he did preach in his opening sermon, if you remember, those of you that heard it, don't go outside the church and learn things about spiritual formation and from the emerging church, you know. And he was absolutely right. And he stood completely behind what the Omega Rebellion is all about. He knows the book. He read it. Matter of fact, what was ironic, about 6 months before that, Angel Rodriguez at the BRI was given my book. Matter of fact, the lady picked up 5 copies from my church, sat in his office with Lincoln Steed, and they read sections of it. And Angel said, thank God. You know, I haven't known what to do about this spiritual formation problem for the last month I've been dealing with it. And he held up my book and he said, now I know, you know. But that was not an official going through the BRI, you know. It would have taken up to a year to go through the BRI. So we just didn't do it. We just let the book come out. And it came out. And again, I prayed for a year and a half, Rosing and I. We said, Lord, we don't even want to know when it comes out. You do it. We don't want to be the ones that try to market this or get it out before our people. And that's exactly what happened. It was somebody out here in California. And I got a phone call from that person. Then the next phone call I got the next day was from the publisher, and they said, we want to print your book. That was the first I heard. And I said, wonderful. You know, that's great. How much? $5,000. Okay, I don't have it, but let's see if this is God's will. We'll see. I'll give you a call in a couple of weeks. The next day, I get a call from an old friend that inherited millions. And he said, Rick, it's covered. It's paid for. Tell him, call him back. This was the next day. This is after waiting a year and a half. Okay? And this was all done behind my back. I didn't even know that it was occurring out here. All right? And it's the same person who set this up for me to be speaking to you today. You know, so God used that person to set up he's the one who set the tour up, you know, that he kept calling me up. I said, okay, yeah, okay, I'll do that. Yeah, okay, you know. And God used this man to get the book out into the hands of our people, to set the tour up out here. So anyway, I've shared this with you as the end of the story, okay, after 35 years of ministry. Now I'm going to go back. I'm going to go back to the beginning and how God led Rosalie and I into the Seventh-day Adventist Church, the truth. And it is the truth. And it is the remnant church. You all agree with that? All right. This is the remnant church. You know, a lot of people today in our church, they don't even want to use that word for some reason, because it doesn't make us look good to the other Protestant churches, you know. And to some, the primary goal is to be an accepted part of the sisterhood of Protestant churches. Folks, we'll never be an accepted part of the sisterhood of Protestant churches, ever, unless we take our unique message and throw it away. All right? Because our unique message separates us from those churches. Those churches had an opportunity 160 years ago now, to accept the first and second angels' messages. But they rejected them. And when they rejected those messages, they no longer were God's people. It was their decision. You know, it was just kind of like Martin Luther. Martin Luther discovers the truth, you know, righteousness by faith. He takes it back to his Roman Catholic Church. Oh, wait, I can't wait to share this wonderful truth, you know, with my leadership. And when he did, what happened? Did they accept it? No. They rejected him and forced him to recant or die, essentially. You know, but God protected him. And the same thing happened to Ellen White, you know. She said it was one of the saddest days in her life when she went back to her Methodist church to bring the Millerite movement truth that was being spread, you know. No, they didn't want to hear it. So the Protestant churches, who were God's people all the way up until that period in time when they rejected the first and second angels' messages, you know, are no longer God's people. It's as simple as that. So why would we want to be accepted and be a part of the sisterhood of that group that are no longer God's people? It's called Babylon. It's called Babylon. And that doesn't make you popular with them. It doesn't. All right. But we're not talking about people. We're talking about the institutions, the denominations. All right. God, though, has only one denominated group of people in the world today: the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And did you know why? Did you ever wonder? I did before I was a Christian, Seventh-day Adventist Christian anyway. I was brought up in the Christian Science Church for a while, then the Presbyterian Church. Did you ever wonder why wasn't there a prophet for 2,000 years? You know, I often wondered that. And many of our own Seventh-day Adventist people today don't realize why. Ellen White makes a statement: as soon as God had a denominated people with the law of God as their standard, he reinstituted the prophetic gift. See that? It was the Ten Commandments. for almost 2,000 years, there were no denominated people that believed in the Ten Commandments, even though there were commandment keepers at different places. All right, but that's why there was no prophet during that whole 2,000-year period. But as soon as there was a group of people, he finally had them, the remnant people, that came out of Babylon, and they were denominated, and they accepted the law of God as their standard, God reinstituted the prophetic gift. You know, that's the truth. I didn't realize that until about 2 years ago, after being in the ministry for 35 years. You know, why it has been that way. Well, I grew up in Long Island, as did Rosalie, suburb of New York, about 20 miles out from New York City. And my dad was a musician. He was on staff at NBC, played in the Johnny Carson show for 15 years. First with Skitch Henderson, and then some of you old-timers might remember these names. Then Doc Severinsen. And then when that Johnny Carson show moved out here to California, you get all the good stuff out here, you know. Moved out here to California, good stuff. You know, how easy we go back to our own life, you know, old life. But anyway, then Dad went, well, you know, I mean, he played some with the New York Philharmonic on call. He did lots of jingles. He played on, he did Hello Dolly for 8 years on Broadway. And so he was a musician. He played woodwinds, flute, clarinet, sax, considered one of the one or two finest flute players in New York City during his tenor. So as a kid, you know, I can remember going in to the Johnny Carson show, Steve Allen show he did sometimes, and I'd in those days, you could actually run around behind the cameras on stage, you know, behind the stage, rather. And I did, you know, I would go in there and watch the way things took place. It was exciting. It was fun. And years later, I would kind of sneak in, you know, and go up on the roof of the NBC building and, you know, walk right along the edge in 30-mile-an-hour winds with, you know, half a bottle of scotch. Craziness. Folks, craziness, you know. And God saved me, and he had his hand on me then, because I did so many foolish things. I should have lost my life I don't know how many times. Delivered from alcohol when I was 18, though, and wound up growing 2 8-foot-tall marijuana plants next to my house on Long Island. I was into farming, you know. And this was before police even knew what marijuana looked like. My cousin was nice enough to give me one of those little funny cigarettes, you know. And she lived in Queens, and I visited with her, and she gave me this cigarette. And before I smoked it, I wanted to look at it. So I opened it, and there were 2 seeds in there. And I kept the seeds and planted them next to my house. And that's wound up with 2 shopping bags full of marijuana for the next 2 years that me and my friends used. And I was an evangelist. I was an evangelist against alcohol for marijuana because of all the trouble I got in because of drinking all the way through high school, throwing up drunk every week, swearing alcohol, never again, and then just turning around and getting drunk the next night, you know. Well, marijuana didn't do that, you know. Marijuana was Chinese food and Star Trek and laughing all night long. You know, that was a lot better than the trouble I used to get into, you know, drinking. And it just took, though, a few years to realize that, you know, there's an evil with marijuana. And I'll share more about that evil this afternoon. You young people, maybe I should share it now, you know, because this is so important for our young people to understand who are tempted by marijuana, because they're told, it's not addictive, don't worry, it's not like alcohol, you know. It doesn't affect you. And after all, you know, adults in our country drink enough. Why can't we do a little grass, you know? I'll tell you why. Now listen carefully. There is something that happens in the mind that you learn to do when you study the supernatural. When you're a witch, a psychic, an astrologer, a spirit medium, you learn to manipulate and control your thoughts and enter into altered states of consciousness. And within the realm of spiritual formation, this teaching that the Omega Rebellion is about, there is a place called the silence that you reach when you practice contemplative prayer. How many have heard of contemplative prayer? Okay. That's the kind of prayer that's used in spiritual formation. And by the way, it was Pope John Paul II who said, contemplative spirituality, which means the ability to practice centering and contemplative prayer and entering into the silence, all right, is the main tool in the evangelization of the world in the Roman Catholic Church. That's from the mouth of Pope John Paul II in his most important apostolic letter. Right? It is the main tool in the evangelization of the world. This is what the Roman Catholic Church plans to use to win the whole world back to its worship community. Spiritual formation. Contemplative spirituality. Which we're teaching. We're helping. You know? The required reading in the spiritual formation courses that we teach in our schools is Ignatius Loyola and all other mystics who have written about how to go into the silence. Now, because of the Omega Rebellion and because of our new General Conference president, we don't teach that anymore in class. Matter of fact, they don't admit that they ever taught it, but they did, okay? But it's still the required reading. Those are the books that are required for our young ministers, men and women, who are studying for ministry. They need to read this stuff. And the reason is given, they need to learn, you know, how the enemy is at work out there. Folks, that is not right thinking. It's just not right thinking. And I'll just say this because it's the truth. It's an excuse. It's an excuse to keep teaching something that they shouldn't be teaching, period. All right? And that's why this book is so divisive. And that is why I didn't want to be responsible for it coming out. I knew what would happen. I mean, you know, when you have a book that says what you're teaching is a satanic deception to our teachers or our professors, you know, that's difficult to handle. But it's the truth. It is the truth. God is the one who brought this all about, and I say this with all the confidence in the world. Now is the time that God is having our church deal with this deception and take care of it and finish it. All right? But it's difficult for those involved with teaching it to get to the place where they can see that or accept that. And this afternoon I'll share why it's so difficult for them. Right. The name of the book is The Omega Rebellion. Rebellion. What is that all about? We're going to talk about that this afternoon. All right. So, I grew up in Long Island. I graduated high school, and that summer, that musical talent passed me by. All I had was rhythm, and I was tapping all my life. I was tapping, driving my mom and everybody else crazy around me. And I had a friend who played the guitar, and he went to another school for 1 year, and he met someone who played really, really good lead guitar. So they got together over my house and played and jammed, and it was great. And they said, hey, let's get a band going. We need a drummer. And I said, you know, can you wait a month? I'll go take 2 lessons a week, and I know that in a month, you know, I'll be ready. And I was. I went, took 2 lessons a week, and we got our first job in a college bar on Long Island. And we were together for the next 5 years, called the Iridescence. Joined the Musicians Union, even played on Palladium Hall on Broadway. You know, we had a good band that just did everything the Beatles ever did. When the Beatles came out with a song, we learned it right away. you know. Rolling Stones, it was that era back in the 60s. And we used to practice sometimes at my house and sometimes at Frank's house and sometimes at Sal's house. Sal was the lead guitarist. And my favorite was Sal's house because when we practiced over his house, his little sister, she was only 14 years old and I was 18, but we started just looking at each other, you know, looking at each other. And she had these beautiful eyes. Rosalie, stand up. You want to show everybody your eyes? And there she is. And, you know, it was like, Rick, what are you doing? You know, she's 14. What am I going to do? Wait. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to wait, you know. And when she was 17, I took her to the senior prom. And when I was 24 and she was 20, we were married. And we've been married 43 years. And God knew that I needed her because I needed her as a pastor's wife, and I was going to be a pastor. I didn't know this, but the Lord knew that and brought us together. I mean, there were a million people living between where we lived on Long Island, which was only about 5 miles. But if you've ever been on Long Island, it is nonstop people. You know, she lived in Franklin Square. I lived in New Hyde Park. And God's hand was in it, even back then. He was saving my life from all the stupid things that I did for some future thing. But during that time, I would have some supernatural experiences. I didn't tell many people about them. They were frightening and exciting. What time is it? How you know, Pastor John, how much time? 20? Okay. I had these experiences at night when I would go to sleep where I would actually fall asleep, but then I would be awakened by an electrical sensation going through my whole body. And I don't think I've ever spoken anywhere where someone else says, I know what you're talking about. It happens to me too. It's called the night tremors sometime. But you wake up paralyzed with this electrical sensation. I used to call them the vibrations, you know. But something funny would happen. When I would awaken in that state, I could control it with my mind. I could allow myself to sink deeper or to rise up out of it. It was frightening. And the only way to stop it was to physically move some part of my body. But I was paralyzed. I couldn't move. And, you know, so I would muster up all the willpower I could to move an arm, a leg, anything, and it would stop. My heart would be pounding, I'd be sweating, and if I just rolled over and went right back to sleep, I'd fall right back into this, whatever it was. Anybody here ever have anything like that? Yeah, okay. There's always one or two or more, you know, that have experienced this. And books... articles have been written about it recently. Back when it was happening to me, there was nothing out there. You know, nothing was spoken about this. However, there was something else that happened. There were times when I would be out of my body when this would take place. I would notice a separation between myself and my body. Sometimes I'd be facing the other direction. And when I would wake myself up, I'd wake up facing this way. But I was just facing that way, and I was looking at the clock, and it was 10 to 2. And I turn around, and it's 10 to 2. You know, it was like, so I really was looking over there, but it wasn't me, because I'm facing this way. So these kind of things went on for a while. Scared me, didn't know what it was. Wound up... After having gone to college, working now for American Cyanamid Company as a chemical research, went out for lunch, went to a bookstore, and I saw a book entitled Journeys Out of the Body by Dr. Robert Monroe. And I grabbed that book, looked interesting, opened it up and said, I want to get this. I brought it back to work. I started reading it. Lo and behold, this book is about hundreds of experiences that Dr. Monroe had where he was out of his body, supposedly, performing astral projection. But the prerequisite to having this ability to separate and to leave his body was being in a certain state. And when he described the state that he was in, lo and behold, it's exactly the state that I was experiencing for years. Now, this was fascinating to me. Why? It meant there was a spirit world or something. There was more to life than just what we think life is all about. And I became absolutely obsessed with finding out the meaning of life. I couldn't stop saying to myself, what more important question can a human being seek to find an answer for while they're alive than the purpose of their existence? Why am I here? What is life all about? And the more I thought about that question, the more I realized there is nothing more important than finding the answer to that question. And I became obsessed with it. I mean, I loved chemistry, but I loved this more. I wanted to find out, why am I here? What is life all about? And I started searching and praying. I didn't know who I was praying to. I didn't know what the truth was. I didn't know who God was. You know, I didn't know if it was Buddha or Krishna or whoever. But I wound up praying 4, 5, 6 hours every day for 5 years. Pleading with God, whoever he was, lead me to the truth. I don't want to be fooled, but I want to know what life is all about. And if you have a truth in this world, lead me to it. That went on. And I wound up going to a spirit medium. You know, and I can remember standing in her doorway in New Canaan, Connecticut, a very wealthy suburb of New York City. I'm standing there and I'm looking down. I made an appointment to meet with her. I was involved in this now, and I'm searching all these different supernatural avenues of truth because that's what was happening to me. You know, I figured this is the place to start if you want to know what truth is. Well, certain things are happening to me, and I said, this I know is true. You know, I'm having these supernatural psychic experiences. So I started to get involved in psychic phenomena and spiritualism with the spirit medium. And of course, she told me things about my life, told Rosalie things about her that she couldn't possibly know. So I knew that the supernatural was real. And we were told that we were destined to be spirit mediums ourselves, that's what was happening in our lives. We were, you know, these powers were coming out in us right now because we were part of this group of people in the world that were going to lead the whole world into the age of Aquarius, you know. Well, not quite. But it was a nice ego trip at the time, you know what I'm saying? To be told that you have a power that is supernatural, that is unique, and that you have it because you're an old soul. You have reincarnated many, many times. In other words, you're way ahead in advance of the rest of the population in this world, you know. And that kind of feeds the ego, you know, of people who don't know any better, don't understand Christianity, which we didn't. This was real to us. It was really happening. And she invited me to her house, this spirit medium. I didn't really know what it was I was going to, but it was a seance. And on the way up to her house, I developed the worst headache that I have ever had in my life. The right side of my head up here was pounding with every heartbeat, with more intense pain than I've ever had in any headache, ever. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know whether to turn around and go back home, keep going. But I kept going. Got to her house, knocked on the door, walked in, and here's a whole group of people. And I thought I was going to be the only one there, that we were having, I was meeting with her over something. And all these people sit down in this circle, invited me to come and sit down. I sit down. The person next to me over here says, who's got the headache? And I said, yeah, I've got the headache. And they said, oh, I can feel it. It's right up here on the right side of your head. This supernatural was, this was a part of what was happening. It's a part of what you learn and practice in psychic phenomena. There's clairvoyance, clairaudience. You know, there's the ability to be able to feel what other people are feeling, which is what this person next to me was experiencing with me with the headache. It's all a phony trick. Anyway, by the way, I just want you to know that. When you go to a psychic or an astrologer and they tell you something that appears to be the truth, okay, it's not because they have any ability to know something about you that they shouldn't know. They have a demon working with them that knows everything about you. They've been following you for your whole life. And that demon whispers in the ear, their ear, something about you, and they go, oh, you know, I just had this thought that you went to college at Fordham University. Is that true? Yeah. Wow, I did. How did you know that? You know? Yeah, well, it looks like they have some psychic power, but they don't. They don't. Okay? If they say something that you're thinking, well, you're thinking about this right now, and they say something, and you go, wow, that's right. That's exactly what I was thinking. It's not because they were reading your mind. It's because the fallen angels that are working, the demons that are working with them and have influence over you sitting in front of them, have the ability to put a thought into your mind and the same thought into their mind. So all of a sudden they have a thought, the same thought that the demon put into your mind. And they say, hey, you're thinking about going swimming, aren't you? And you go, yo, that's right. You know, it looks like they can read your mind. No. There's no supernatural power that we have, folks. None. Right? All this psychic phenomena, all this astrology, when an astrologer sits down there and does your chart, they have a familiar spirit. And there's a whole bunch of positive characteristics and negative characteristics that they're looking at. And that familiar spirit is the one who says, pick this one, this one, this one, while they're filling out your chart. And then when they finally show you your chart, and it's like, wow, that's accurate. You know, yeah, it's accurate, because the astrologer didn't really fill it out. They had a demon, a familiar spirit, working with them as they looked at the positive and negative characteristics, and they were guided in filling that chart out so that it would fit you. And it makes it appear as if there's some kind of power in astrology, or that astrologer has some ability to be able to read your chart. It's all a trick. All right? It's all a trick. Demons are in control of people who decide to do these things. That's why the Bible warns against them. I came home from that seance that night with a message from a spirit that appeared, with a message to me saying that I was on the right track and there was no turning back. I went home from that seance with the belief and the conviction that I could never turn back from what I was involved in. I was scared. I was frightened. I didn't know what was going on. And I swore off spirit mediums from that night on. Matter of fact, I swore off religion. I went over, when I got home, to the shelf, and I took the Bible down and I opened it to Deuteronomy chapter, just one page away, five pages away, chapter 18. And it opened to this page. My eyes fell down on verse 10, and I started to read. Now remember, I just came home from a seance. There shall not be found among you anyone that makes his son or his daughter to pass through the fire, or that uses divination, or an observer of times, an astrologer, or an enchanter, or a witch, or a charmer, or a consulter with familiar spirits, or a wizard, or a necromancer. I didn't know what necromancer was, so I went to a dictionary and looked it up, and it said one who communicates with the dead. And that's what I was just doing. For all that do these things are an abomination unto the Lord. And because of these abominations, the Lord thy God doth drive them out from before thee. Wow. Here I was. I'm doing this very thing, that the Bible just warned I shouldn't be doing. And it's an abomination to God. Now, I had to come to the place in my life at that moment. Do I believe this? Am I going to accept this? Excuse me. I had to decide. Is this true, or am I being? Is this just written thousands of years ago by people who didn't know what was really going on? And I didn't know what to do. And I put the Bible back, and I said, "Okay, I don't know if this is true or not, but I'm never going back to that spirit medium." Matter of fact, it's been 4 years. I've been searching for the truth. I quit. I give up. I can't do this anymore. And I went about. I was so scared because of what I had done. And I read in Proverbs chapter 3 about a woman who happened to be a harlot. But in my mind, that was the woman that I went to, the spirit medium. And I was convinced that I was going to die. You want to know what real desolation feels like? I felt and believed in my heart that I was going to experience the second death. It was it. I was going to be wiped out of existence forever because of what I did. And I really believed that. And I believed it so much, I was afraid to go to sleep. I said, if I go to sleep and fall, I'm never going to wake up. I know it. And I had my sister and Rosalie take turns holding their hand on my chest. I said, if I fall asleep, wake me up. Don't let me fall asleep. And this went on for a couple of days. It was craziness. And I swore off anything to do with religion for about a week. I couldn't stop. I had to find what the truth was, and I said, no. So I stopped. I went to work up in Connecticut, the American Sanova Company. On my way home, I stopped at an ashram. I always loved Hinduism, India. And I went into this ashram. I told one of the disciples there what happened, what's been going on in my life, and they said, it's very interesting. Bring us a picture of you and your wife and your children, and we'll give you a picture of the guru. And you meditate on his picture, and he'll meditate on your picture, and we'll know whether you are destined to be his disciple or not. Okay? Well, I took that picture home. This was the guru of Santana. And there was a very elite group of about 40 disciples. This was in New York. And we were going to find out whether or not we should be his disciple or not. Well, I took that picture home. And I put that picture in front of me. And I got into a meditative position. And when my eyes met the eyes of this guru in that picture, I was paralyzed. I stopped breathing. Flames began shooting out of the picture. I can see it today as if it was happening right now. Flames, yellow flames shooting out. His face would appear, disappear, go blank, appear, disappear. And I'm just like, I'm stuck here. I can't move. I can't breathe. It was a fascinating experience and a frightening experience. And it lasted for, who knows? I don't know how long. Probably 30 seconds or a minute. I don't know. But I know when it stopped, finally, I jumped up. I went out, told Rosalie what happened. I said, I don't know what just happened, but it was incredible. And the next day, I stopped at the ashram, and I told them what happened. And they said, oh, that's wonderful. That means you're supposed to be his disciple. And we have word from him that you and your family ought to be accepted into his highest order of disciples. Oh, okay. So we became disciples of Sri Chinmoy. And the teaching of this guru was that this book, the Bible, how are we doing, like 5 minutes maybe? Okay. This book was the truth, right? It contained a genuine path to God, okay? We were also taught that Sri Chinmoy was our savior. He would take our karma, our sins upon himself. We were also taught that he was like Christ, only greater. He had transcended Christ. You see, the Eastern religions, the occult, the psychic phenomena, we're all God, right? We are all God. Christ was a self-realized master. He realized that he was God. When you become self-realized, you'll realize that you're God also. That spirit medium gave me a book called Three Magic Words that I was to study in my path to being a spirit medium. You know what the three magic words were? I am God. Those are the three magic words. That's what all occultists believe. That's what all Hindus believe. We are all God on the subconscious level. The only thing that separates us is our conscious minds. So we have to learn to bypass the conscious and go into the subconscious. All right? Folks, that's the realm where Satan communicates with us. All right? And you can get there by practicing certain things I'm going to talk about this afternoon. And the silence and contemplative prayer teaches you how to go into that altered state of consciousness. You see how devilish it is? You know? People go there and have a supernatural experience when they practice contemplative prayer and they believe they've come into the presence of God. Oh, wonder of wonders. I've come into the presence of God. No, you haven't. You've entered an altered hypnotic state that psychics and spirit mediums and witches have been using for 5,000 years to practice their religions. It's just that now it has this Christian guise to it. It's been sugar-coated with Christianity and the name of Jesus and everything. And because you don't know any better, you've been deceived. And Satan deceives you when you get into this altered state by allowing you to have some kind of wonderful Christian experience. You see, if you're a Hindu and you go to the silence, you have a Hindu experience. If you're a witch, you have a witch experience. If you're a Buddhist, you'll have a Buddhist experience. Whatever the devil wants you to believe, you go into the altered state, the silence, and you'll have the experience of whatever you think you believe about God. That's how you're deceived by all of this. And in our schools and in all the other Christian schools of the other denominations, when you learn spiritual formation, again, which comes right out of the Jesuits, let's not forget that, and is meant to win the whole world back to Roman Catholicism, what kind of experiences do you think you're going to have when you go there? You know, these folks come into the presence of God, and they have it's a wonderful experience, and they come out of that experience believing that they see God in everybody and in everything. You know, that's the experience that people have who have been to the silence, practicing spiritual formation. Right? They come out of that experience and they think and believe that they see God everywhere. Hey, that's pantheism. That's pantheism. God does not dwell in all people. He dwells only in those who have accepted Jesus as their Savior. Satan dwells in the rest. That's from the spirit of prophecy now. That's not me. So to think that you see God in everybody after you have this wonderful experience with the silence, it's not true. It's not true. Now, very quickly, because I know I'm running out of time here, probably out of time, I just want to say what happened. We became disciples of this guru. I found Acts 4:12 in here where it says, "There is none other name given among men whereby we must be saved." And yet I had a guru who said he was my savior. I said, well, you know, How am I supposed to handle this? Well, Rick, you can't believe everything that's in the Bible. Now what? I thought this was truth, you know? So I just pick what I want. And you pick what you want, and she picks what she wants, and everybody comes up with their own little religion. I wanted the truth. And now it's 5 years I've been searching for it. And I finally said, God, I quit. I'm not looking anymore. That's it. I know that you know if there's any truth in this world. And my search has led me down one dead-end road after another. And I can't do it anymore. I can't. You take over my life and lead me to the truth. Well, within a couple of days, I got a response from a resume that I sent out a year earlier from Union Carbide. Went on an interview. They gave me a job. We had to move quickly end this whole thing. We had to move up near Union Carbide, which is 50 miles away. We're looking at a house. We're looking at this great little cottage on the front end of a, you know, 5-acre estate. Looking at this house, perfect. This is great, you know. And next door, there's a house through the trees. So I said to the man who owns the mansion in the back, I said, if we took this place, who would my neighbor be over there? And he said, now, let me stop for a second. This is 3 weeks after praying that prayer, and every moment of every day, I am looking for an answer. Is it the Bible, God? Is it Jesus? Or is it the occult? What is it? I need to have an answer. But, you lead me. You show me. I said, who would my neighbor be? And he says, I don't know his name. All I know is that he's a minister. My heart almost jumped out of my chest, you know. I said, this is an answer. I know it. I said, what church? He said, Seventh-day Adventist. And I said, who? I was 28. I never heard of the Seventh-day Adventist church. Anyway, I knew that God led us there. And at the first opportunity I had, I ran down there when I saw him outside. And he's a pastor right here in California, John Lupins, all right, down in San Diego. And I told him this story, and he was grinning just like I'm grinning right now, you know, from ear to ear. He knew God led us there. And we wound up having Bible studies twice a week for the next year. We were baptized at camp meeting in Greater New York a year later. But we knew, and I told John, I said, now you don't show me anything. I mean, don't tell me anything that you can't show me. You say, this is the word of God. I want to see it in here. And of course, as you all know, he was able to. I mean, the truth that we have as God's remnant people is the truth, period. You know, there's nothing to be embarrassed by saying we have the truth, right? We do. You know, God has always had a people, always. And today we are his people. You know, just like when Jesus met the woman at the well, Jesus said to that woman, he said, the way of salvation is of the Jews, you know? She wanted to argue theology with him because he was pointing out things in her life that she didn't like, you know. But he said, we have the way of salvation. Now, I'm sure there were a lot of people in the church at that time that said, I wish Jesus wouldn't say things like that. Very embarrassing. You know, what do the other denominations think? You know, folks, we have the truth. God has always had a people who understand the way of salvation. And today, in the world, the Seventh-day Adventist Church understands the way of salvation. He's given it to us to give a message to the world, nothing to be embarrassed about. It's not an ego thing. It's just the fact. It's the way it is. God has always had his people in the world who had the truth to be able to share the way of salvation with the rest of the world, right? Well, today it's us. And don't be embarrassed about that. Don't be embarrassed, but don't be proud about it either. It lays on us a tremendous responsibility to love the people around us with a love that is greater than our love for ourselves, to be willing to give of ourselves without the expectation of getting anything back for it. That's divine love, and that's the kind of love that Jesus will lead you to when you give your heart wholeheartedly to him.